hello, and welcome to Manga Splaining, the show where we recommend great manga to folks who have not read manga before. Hosted by myself, David Brothers, Deb Aoki, Christopher Butcher, and Chip Zdarsky. Follow along with our show notes and reading list at mangasplaining.com. For some reason, saying myself, David Brothers, made it sound like I wasn't David Brothers in my head. That's just the kind of week this is going to be. But so, dearly beloved, we are gathered here today for a very special occasion. Something we kept talking about during the first season was wanting to see the evolution of an artist. And that's kind of tough to do in manga because it means either reading, I don't know, 90 volumes of One Piece or kind of spending an equivalent amount on another artist. So my idea was we read the first chapter of a bunch of series and the first volume of this creator's latest series and discuss kind of how we feel about it, what we think of the evolution, and maybe kind of shortcut our way to a conversation we've been meaning to have for a while. But the artist I chose was Tsutomu Nihei, who works without assistance, which is one reason why I thought he would be interesting for this. Okay. Because in this case, it's actually just like one dude drawing everything. And a friend, Caleb Goldner, he's at Caleb Andrew on Twitter, actually described him in an amazing way. He said, knowing what I know about Nihei, I've kind of grounded his comics as an architect's exploration of existence through mortality and the fight against it. Everything he makes is about whether consciousness can truly be separated from the body and what that means for being truly alive. He drops characters into existing frameworks that they're forced to wander through with no real answers. And first, great description. Thank you, Caleb. Stole it wholesale. But Nihei's comics are fun because there's this weird sense of scale. There's this weird sense of doom. There's this weird feeling overall. And it makes it kind of enthralling to me. Mm. Like I got the first volume of Blam, spelled Blame, back in 2005, 2006, whenever it first dropped. And I could not make heads or tails of it. Like I never actually bought volume two until like the bigger volumes came out.
Yeah.
But it was enthralling. Like because I couldn't figure it out, I had to figure it out. And hopefully we'll end up sparking that feeling in some of the people listening here. So Blam was his first book. We read the first chapter, which is from, I had all this written down, amazingly.
1997. From the 90s.
97. It was his first published manga work. He'd worked in his assistant a little bit. He had a one-shot accepted by a Jiro Taniguchi Award, which is kind of interesting. So he kind of came in with a lot of cool buzz, like he was clearly going somewhere. And I gotta admit, like the first chapter didn't really hit me very hard. It's just kind of generic, like you see where it's going, and then you get to the last page and you have no idea where it's going. So it captured me that way. And I think, Chris, what did you think about the first chapter of Blam?
So I read the series. I'm pretty sure I finished the series, but it was, like I said, it was a long time ago. Tokyo Pop published the first edition in English. It's now available in a really nice series of omnibus collections from Kodansha, actually.
They're disgustingly nice.
They are. And I've got the first one and it's signed because Tsutomu Nihei was at San Diego Comic-Con a number of years ago. The first chapter is not good. It is it's not good. But it's so fascinating to me because it's kind of what I love in comics. And this is something that's going to maybe repeat through the episode for me is that like it's bold and it's reaching. I think its reach exceeds its grasp a little bit. It's trying stuff. It's throwing stuff at the wall. It's brash for sure. And you kind of aren't sure if he's making it up while he goes along. There's so much style. And you're not quite sure if the substance is going to rise to meet the style or not. But it reminds me of a lot of young work. And I think if you can get excited about that, especially if you read it at a time when you hadn't seen The Matrix, it's pre-Matrix, you know, like it was clearly an influence on it. I think I think the first chapter of Blam is probably just enough for the right reader to keep reading.
Yeah.
But I think you read that first volume of Blam and it goes off in like a very, it's a better hook, I think, than the first chapter is alone.
Gotcha. And this isn't me offloading more of my duties as host, but how would you explain what happens in the first chapter? I'm curious.
Like nothing happens.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And you're compounding that by the fact that we've read five first chapters by him before getting to Apple Sims, where it's all kind of the same, actually, a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah. I don't know that I know exactly what happened in Blam, actually having read. Biomega is easier because it's got the bear, but
yeah,
and the motorcycle, yeah.
But like, yeah, Blam, a guy exists in a mysterious place, almost like a gunslinger. There's like a bit of a cowboy western thing going on, although completely separate setting, obviously. This like lone dude enters a space, is attacked by, you know, outlaws beyond human imagining, and you begin to realize that this world that he's in is like, this is much bigger and more oppressive than you thought that the series was going to be. And this, like, these heavy shadows, this techno-organic thing doesn't end. It's like this unending, never-ending world that he's sort of walking through. Stephen King's Gunslinger a little bit, where he's just like on a quest, on a journey that only he really understands, through a world that's done. Yeah, man, it hit the right way 20 years ago for me. And now it's like, well, we'll get to it, but I think I prefer his more mature work a little bit more.
Okay. Deb, how about you? How did chapter one strike you?
It completely flummoxed me.
Great like, word.
Damn, she stole my word.
I mean, it's just kind of, he throws you in this world. He doesn't explain anything. He just kind of, there's no narration. There's no setting up what this world is. It just kind of throws you into this situation where this guy is walking on this bridge and he's a teeny tiny person in a huge world, and there's all kinds of perspective and vanishing lines, and you don't know what this weird place is. And he's with a kid, and you're like, okay, so that feels familiar. There's a guy protecting a kid. And then he runs into very desiccated,
not even zombie looking, like,
yeah, they're Hellraiser, really strange gross people, right? They're like kind of, they're kind of organic looking, and yet they're decayed. And then they're after him, and then he blows them up, and then there's something about genotypes and germs and disease, and it ends, and you're like, wait, what was that thing on the bottom there with the blob of the face?
Yeah.
Was that the kid? Like, I had to go back and forth a couple times, like, what just happened?
Yeah.
And I don't know if, I mean, I have Blam Volume 1 as both a print and a digital version. Mm-hmm. But I got to say, it, like, you know, when you're just kind of lost like this, you're thinking, what?
But back up. You're flummoxed by this, and you have the print and the digital version.
But I only read first chapter because I did the homework.
Okay.
Nice.
Oh, but I did cheat a little. I did go ahead to chapter two, because chapter two had an interesting part about a book, which intrigued me. But maybe
what made you want to go on to chapter two?
Because I could.
She owned it.
Yeah, actually.
You know, like there was at first I did the assignment, and I just went to the Kodansha website and I read the first chapter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I realized, oh, I actually have this. So then I went and looked at it, and I thought, you know, I'm confused. And I went back and forth a couple times in this first chapter. Wait, what happened? Wait, the kid got removed, and what's that? And it's got grabbed by the other guy, and then like, and then at the last thing is like, he looks down, and then there's like this childlike face and this blob of something, and you're like, did the kid die?
And then there's a reaction shot with the statue, and it's like, what do we take from this?
And then he's tiny, and he's walking up the stairs. You can barely tell whether he's got the kid under his arm or whatever that thing is. So at that point, I was like, I guess it's because I can. I'm going to see what happens. I'm going to try and see what the heck just happened here.
She sees that mountain of chapter two, and she climbs it because she can. I like it.
But I don't know if, like, I only saw chapter one on the preview. Mm-hmm. Would I plunk down the money to buy it?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. The part of chapter two that was interesting was there's a moment where they get a book, and then grabs a book, and the book says, "The cold, silent land was lightening as the human figure walked up to the ridge." And then the guy looks at the book and he goes, "What's land?"
It's pretty good.
And I thought, oh, how intriguing. And then so I, because Google is magic, I put the whole phrase into Google, and I found that it's from a short story by James Tiptree.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's from a collection called 10,000 Light Years from Home.
Yeah.
James Tiptree is actually the pen name of Alice Shelton.
Okay. That kind of solves Blam.
I think it rewards reading in that, you know, that he offers little clues. And if you're mm-hmm. patient, you know, you'll get more out of it. But for someone who is used to reading a lot more accessible manga, where mm-hmm. they tell you what the world is and they set up the plot and they set up the conflict, everything very neatly for you. They give you clear pathways into the story. Mm-hmm. This is a little more challenging.
Yeah. Chip, do you agree?
Well, let me just say, I would be flummoxed by this if I cared enough to be flummoxed. Mm. Like, to be flummoxed means, kind of indicates that you have a level of interest to kind of be flummoxed by it. But yeah. Like, I bounce off this after that spread, because the spread's great. The opening spread.
Yeah.
With a single vanishing point, very simple, but really elegant. And then the next page is just a dog's breakfast. Like, it's just like, like layout, pacing, everything just goes out the window, rendering, structure. I was worried because you gave us the list, mm-hmm. and I clicked it, and I just was like, oh God, I pray this is the first work. or else this is going to be bad. Yeah, I realized later it was. Because this is, and you know, I mean, you know, it's the first work, so I can't be upset or anything. I also read mm-hmm. it for free, so I really can't be upset. But it's probably the most high school thing I've ever seen. Like, No, it's not even ouch. It's just like if I saw somebody had drawn like a bunch of these scenes in my high school, I'd be like, this is awesome.
This is literally the best comic you've ever seen at that point.
Yeah, right? But yeah. If I saw this at the end of my college years, I'd be like, oh, dude, like, come on. And it makes a lot of sense. Because like when Deb said that line from the book, I'm just like, well, that's actually really good. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, she realized somebody else wrote it.
Of course I did.
Yeah. So I bounced off this. I bounced off this pretty hard. Like after that, really, it's a beautiful opening, and there are a couple more kind of like big scenes which are used to great effect, which obviously he gets much better at later, like by his most recent work or whatever in our list. The expansive scenes are as if they're done by a master at that point. So you can see the inkling of that here, but then the characters just fall apart, the rendering falls apart, and the layouts really fall apart. So it's like, yeah, I found myself really kind of flipping through this, being like, okay, I'm hoping the next one's better.
Yeah, there's a face on page 7, panel 3, where Achilles just kind of looking at a guy, and it just doesn't work for me. Like, it has that high school feeling you're talking about.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see what, I know exactly what face you mean.
Yeah.
It's not, like, the nose isn't in the right place. Like, if you look at that, and then you look at panel 4, 5, 6 as well, his mm-hmm. nose has dropped like 2 inches.
And weirdly, it's the hair. Like, that's such young way of drawing like manga or anime style hair, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There were a lot of young people in my life that drew exactly like this after this came out.
And also, like, this is all nice. Like in an admiring way, I think. We're not making fun so much as being like,
no,
this is what it was. And this is kind of why it worked.
This reminds me of like Trent young work.
Trent Reznor, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like that look.
Yeah, for
cover art.
But even, this opening scene of just the bridge, it's like, after you have that nice shot of the bridge means nothing after that point. Like, it's used as such little effect and poorly drawn, and also, like, oh man, just like, the fact that they repeat the kind of the same kind of shot of the bridge twice, but it's supposed to be in an opposite direction. Like, it's just really bad layout choices here. Looking at them, like, oh, you love
it's
it?
Super ambitious.
No, I love that you zeroed in on the bridge. Yeah, like Deb saying, it's super ambitious because he leans into the bridge side of things and away from the talking about things side of things.
Yeah.
So the later volumes of this, you can see, like, he was trained as an architect and he went to art school in New York. And you can see the architect in him come out. Like, it's very claustrophobic. Like, he'll draw a picture of an enormous room, like a very tiny person, and you will still get, like, the willies, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, yeah, very, very strange choices here.
There are some nice shots, though. I want to go on record here. This is page, I guess, 9 or 10. I can't tell because of the backwards forwards thing that's going on with this preview reader. But bottom of page 9, where he's like falling backwards through the air, shooting a gun, and he explodes the zombie guy in half.
Yeah.
That's good. That terrible. Looks like that's photo-refed.
No. Look at his body. Now take a look at his body. Look at his shoe. His shoe goes straight into his leg. Like that is just like that is his one shape that makes zero sense. Mm. And even his arm and hands on the gun.
Foreshortening. It's all foreshortening. I can totally see it.
No, you can see it, but you're supposed to be able to make it out based on the silhouette. If you silhouetted that, you wouldn't be able to make out the fact that he's firing a gun, the fact that he has a foot. Mm. Like the fact that the foot angles up exactly in line with the leg is one of the worst tangents you could do. And then
Zdarsky and his red pen on the layout.
No, if he popped that gun out just a little bit more, so even if he got the tip of the gun out, like there would be so much more dynamism to that character. It would work so much better. Because right now it's just the legs are just like out and his body's just like whatever. And his head is normal. His head is if he's standing.
I'm hearing someone who didn't like Rob Liefeld in high school talk right now. That is a problem.
I will say this exact pose, the falling back, shooting legs up pose, he gets much better at as time goes on.
Yeah.
Specifically that pose. It's kind of a trip.
Yeah.
But so the next work was Noise.
Sorry, Chris.
Universe.
No, I'm fine.
set in the same universe as Blam. And essentially, Blam is set so far in the future, like the Earth exists. This is spoilers, but not really. There's only kind of a narrative. The Earth exists in a Dyson sphere. So he wanders like literally to Jupiter, like the distance over the course of the series in like one chapter. Like it's just like a caption box where they just casually mention it. But this, I think, is set a little bit before the drastic expansion in another area where it's like a police procedural. They find a dead body. A cop disappears. One lady thinks she's seeing things. Like, there's weird stuff going on. Let's start with Chip for Noise, and then work our way back around to Deb and then Chris. What did you think about this one?
Okay. So, like, in charting the progress.
Yeah.
There was some cockiness that happened after the first launch. And then coming into this, the artist was like, oh, I intrinsically know what to do, so I'm just going to just do it. And then it doesn't work. Like it's like the figures are more interesting because he's loosened up, but he also hasn't figured out the structure of how to present people. It's just like a gothic mess. And it really took me back to my early days of manning a table at comic conventions, where I'd look down the row. Maybe this is just like I've got some trauma here from it. Looking down the row while I'm trying to sell my black and white comics at like some goth dude with a lineup of goths buying their comics. And when I see the comics, it's just scribble, scribble, scribble without form. Like, it's just like, look at this. Look at how dark this is. I'm like, but you haven't done anything. Like, you actually haven't aided the panels or the scene in any way with your mark making. Like, it's just, you've just decided to be a mess. And so I see a lot of that here, which wildly distracts me from getting into the story. So I bounce off. I don't want to make it seem like I'm going to hate their work forever, because it really does turn around pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But this felt like kind of a goth experiment in producing work with maybe a bit more speed. And the layouts are better, for sure. Mm. They're still not that good, and definitely nowhere near as good as they get later on, but they're definitely better.
And it looks like Deb has a rebuttal.
Rebut, Deb.
rebut.
Take him down a peg.
No. And I mean, I hear you. It's a little bit less scratchy. He's doing more darks, and he's trying to set a mood. Mm-hmm. But the thing that throws me off about this one is that the girl's eyes are way too far apart.
Yeah. They really are. I mean, it's less that they're too far apart. Like, I don't mind that as a stylistic thing, but they grow farther apart. which is weird. Like, I'm looking at, it's hard to tell, with the page 22 and the bottom two panels of her, where she's saying, "What is this place?" Her eyes are far apart. Mm-hmm. She's also has no emotion on her face, really. That's also an issue with the art. But then the panel just to the left of it, her eyes have, I think, grown even farther apart.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's funny is the facing page, I feel like, is a good example of Nihei's approach to design at this point in his career.
Okay.
Where it's like, what would make an awesome heavy metal cover?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. For sure.
All the monsters in this are kind of in that genre.
Yeah.
And it works. Like, they're really kind of the empty face designs, like the gross ribs and things like that.
Yeah.
Very Geiger.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Definitely going through a phase here.
I think there's a stage in a young artist's life where you can, and this happens in a lot of creators, right? Where you can definitely see their influences. Mm-hmm. You can definitely see where their interests lie.
Yeah.
And where they're grabbing what they think is cool and they're trying to mesh it into their style. Mm-hmm. It's still very nascent.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, I think I admire his ambition.
Mm-hmm.
He's really trying to do a lot here. I mean, there's like ton in this particular first chapter, there's a ton of different settings.
Yeah.
You know, there are all kinds of rooms and like rooms full of guns and bricks, and it's just tons of settings. Like, it's and almost too many. Like, it jumps from scene to scene to scene to scene to scene. Where am I? What am I doing? What is this place? Wait, how is this a prequel to Blam? I don't get it.
Yeah, even go back to one scene and it's a different setting. Like, it's been cleaned up in the interim between the panels. Yeah.
But you can definitely see that he definitely has themes that he likes to explore. Mm-hmm. And you'll see, like, you know, these creatures with the humanoid faces and the Geiger like bodies, like they're kind of organic, but they're still scary. They're not quite skeletons. Mm. They're like insects almost.
Yeah.
Biomechanical.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you can, and this thread, you know, runs throughout his entire work. I still don't get what's going on. But, you know, yeah. I'm a little dumb that way.
Yeah. Chris, how about you? Do you get what's going on?
Actually, this one seemed a lot more straightforward than Blam did to me. It's like, okay, you've got this setting. And this, I went and looked, before I actually read this, I went to see when this was drawn. And he started drawing it in the middle of Blam. He went and did this like little side story called Noise. Mm-hmm. And 2000, so like 3-4 years after Blam started. And it's like, okay, I want to tell a smaller story with like a beginning, middle, and end. And you can see that it's like, he starts off, it's like, it's a police procedural. There is more of a beginning, middle, and end, but he's still a young artist. Like, he's still obsessed with drawing things that look cool to him without necessarily the artistic fundamentals at the core of his drawing. So yeah, like, it's good that you mentioned the eye thing, because yeah, the protagonist's eyes are never consistently, like, it's not even stylistically, they're different. They're too far apart. It's just panel to panel. They keep moving all over. Like, there's one panel where they're literally almost on the sides of their head, and it's not a stylistic choice. It's just like, he was doing this weekly. Like, that's the other thing. He's doing this
speed here
weekly at 24 years old or something insane.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, let's just slap it down with like crazy ideas. You know what I mean? Like, that page where the monster is revealed at the end of chapter monster, the blank face, the like biomechanical monster skeleton body coming up through the mist. It's cool. Like, it's cool. And it's not good, but it's like really cool. And this is the kind of thing where you like show somebody this and it's like, this spawns 1,000 doujinshi and mini comics and it's starts funny, people drawing shit.
I'm looking at that page, the two facing pages. And I'm like, yeah, it's very cool. But then, like, on the page right after the reveal, the monster shrinks by two sizes.
Yeah.
Because in the previous page, like, our main character's in the foreground and tiny, and this monster's just looming. It's awesome. And then the next page, like, she's in the background, and she's almost as big as it is.
Yeah.
It's very, very...
Force perspective.
Reverse foreshortening? I don't understand.
If you go to the next page, though, it's a side profile of her shooting a gun at the monster. Look how far back her eyes are set in her face.
Yes. This is such a fast drawn. I mean, that's the thing. Like the fact that you explained that they were doing it while doing the other book makes so much sense. Like this is where they were blowing off steam to be like, fuck it. I'm putting these lines down. There's no pencils here. I'm just going for it.
It's all energy. And I actually love it. Like I love it, but you can, yeah, look at any single one of these panels and just pick it to pieces because there's so many like artistic problems with them. But
it's
energetic.
Yeah, the last comic is high school. This comic is art school.
Okay,
like that's progression because like art school is just all about figuring out the style.
Yeah,
and maybe going a bit too goth. I knew a guy who drew almost exactly like this in art school.
Yeah, he probably owned this.
Yeah,
he probably owned this. So it makes a lot of sense.
Cool. And then kind of if you were on comics internet around 2008, 2009, 2010, you heard about Biomega mostly because of the bear with the rifle.
Yes.
Which instant hit. Everyone who's seen it has been like, no, like I want to know more about this bear. Deb, what did you think about Biomega back in the day? And what do you think about it now?
I really liked it then just because it was so audacious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it was kind of like, you know, like how Knight Rider, where there's a talking car.
Yeah.
He has this talking motorcycle and it's just kind of like this, it's a lot faster moving than Blammer Noise.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost, I like the energy in manga where it's like, you know what? Huff physics, huff science, huff gravity, huff whether this can be built or not. It is because I say it is.
Tough where I should be.
You know what I mean? It's just kind of this, I don't, this world is because I say it is. Things work like that because I say it does. Why is there a bear? Because I want a bear. Why are there no other animals? I don't care.
Yeah.
I do like that Deb really cemented that this is a swearing episode. Physics, science, health anatomy, perspective.
Sorry.
Oh, man. No,
can't
great.
Even bleep those ones. Like, I don't know what we're going to do now.
No, sorry, David.
Yeah, this is a seinen manga. It's appropriate.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
But also, that is basically the feel of Biomega. It opens on, or rather, I'm sorry, the third page or so. Is a guy driving across a bridge at night on a cool motorcycle at 666 miles an hour.
Yep. Like, I love that.
Like, if you're not into that, like, I don't know.
Yeah. Or
kilometers an hour, I'm sorry.
Still.
Yeah.
Chip, what did you think? You said you liked the bear. What did you think about the rest of Biomega?
It's very pretty. They definitely leveled up a lot here. How many years was there different between the previous book and this book?
2004 was Biomega, so I'd say that was about...
So he finished Biomega right after he did Blam and the other book.
The difference between Noise and Biomega is about 3 years.
Okay.
Okay.
This is a much better, much more confident work. Mm-hmm. And the mark-making reinforces the environment. They're better perspective here as well, like playing around with it. Like there's a double page spread of the character dead on the street, and you've got some really interesting kind of worm's eye stuff happening, distortion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very pretty. The environments are very pretty. The figures still, there are a few issues here and there, but overall it's a massive step up from the previous two. When the bear showed up, I laughed. And I was like, wait, is this a cultural thing? Because there's a bear that shows up in the later book, too, that we looked at.
Yeah.
And I'm like, do bears just show up? Is it supposed to be funny
Deb
or not
asked
funny?
About this at a Comic-Con. Deb, can you tell the bear story?
Oh. Well, because, I mean, that was one of my favorite things about Biomega, that there's all of a sudden there's this bear.
Yeah.
And, And then I asked him in the interview, I said, oh, what's up with the bears, man? And then he says, oh, well, bears are have expressive faces. Yeah. There's, I'm not going to say anything more about that. And then sure enough, when the panel comes along, right, there's Q&A. So someone comes up to the mic and goes, dude, what's up with the bears? And then he makes this loud sigh and he goes, it means nothing at all. Like the feeling I got was that every interviewer after me asked him out about the effing bears.
Well, yeah, if you're going to throw a bear in the middle of this like dark, you know, Akira style epic or whatever, people are going to ask you about the bear. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And a really well-drawn bear as well.
A really well-drawn bear.
Yeah.
So I don't know the story, and he's never said it, but I was rereading that interview I did with him from that Comic-Con, and he's really funny and self-deprecating, you know? Yeah.
Mm.
Right. Like, he kind of like when he looks back at Blam, like, because he and I were going to art school at about the same time.
Mm.
So I was telling him, it's like, oh, you know, what would you tell if you could go back and talk to your 20-something-year-old self who's living in New York, wanting to be an architect, what would you tell him? And he would say, don't draw so much black. It may look cool to you now, but it's a big pain in the ass later.
Also, forget the bear.
Yeah.
Don't draw the bear. People are just going to ask you about it.
So I walked into that interview not really liking his work too much. I wasn't like a big, big fan.
Mm-hmm.
But I came away like really appreciating how self-deprecating and funny he is. You know,
that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, Biomega is much more playful than Blam or Noise. There is a Blam comedy spinoff where it's like a high school setting that was kind of fun.
I was reading that.
Yeah. What?
Chris, amazing. How did Biomega hit you?
This is the one where I felt like I didn't read it when it came out, actually. I kept meaning to read it, but there was so much stuff coming out in 2010. It was right before the crash. And that it was just like, oh man, I'll get to it one day. I'll get to it one day. And I never did. So even though I have them all because of having worked at Viz. So I actually went to read the first chapter and it just booted me into the first volume, actually. And I read the whole thing. It was really compelling, actually. The story is a story, which is great. And it makes it hard now because I just had to check to see where chapter one ended so I would know where the conversation actually got to. But like, he is not only upped his game, like Chip was talking about, in terms of like his stylistic quirks now serve the story rather than detract from them. He's better at his rendering and he still has those amazing double page spreads, like on the bike approaching the city, and the city looks like it's just like Satan lives there, like just like Satan lives
ultra
there.
London.
Yeah, it's just the worst, but also kind of amazing. Like really beautiful, like cool ideas still, especially to do with architecture and scale. But the story just is crazy. Like it's, and I don't think you get enough of a sense of the stakes in the first chapter. I read a thing about Biomega afterwards, after I finished the first volume. And it was like in Blam, he was just as a creator wandering through this space. You know what I mean? Like, he's created this environment. He just wants to wander through. Halfway through, he's like, oh, I have an idea for a completely different story in this setting, and goes back and tells the police procedural set in time. Whereas for this one, the plot really just kicks into gear and keeps going. By the end of the first volume, like, spoilers, but not spoilers, he is literally shooting nuclear missiles out of the sky with like a laser beam to save the Earth from being exploded by the bad guys. And you're just like, oh, things have progressed here in like a lot of different, like, not only are the ideas bigger, they're coming quicker. And I think that that's really cool. I think you only get the briefest hint of that in the first chapter, which still moves pretty quick. It's got a bear, it's got a girl, it's got a guy, it's got crazy action, gross monsters, beautiful settings. And it's like, oh yeah, I would, if it was on my iPad, I would click next, or I would, like, if I was browsing it in a store, I'd probably have to see where it goes. But because I had it all, I read the first volume and I'm like, oh man, I gotta go read the second one. But I ran out of time before we had to record today, so I can't go read it. But yeah, it's good. And it didn't do well. I sort of heard through the grapevine when it came out, it was not one of the ones that did it as well. And I honestly think it's safe to say that if this had come out as comic book issues, it could have maybe caught hold in the sort of superhero space in a way that I think even Apple Sims, which we'll get to in a minute, also maybe could have.
Yeah.
It's a lone guy who's super cool. He has a gun. He's rescuing a girl. There are clearly defined bad guys. And there's just enough of a to get you to see what's in the next issue, especially if this is like a double-sized first issue for $3. I felt like this is the one where it's like, well, comic book retailer for 22 years, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
But yeah, straight up, I think that this one, I don't know that it got a fair chance, unfortunately. It was published, it was printed, you know what I mean? But I think if it had been, I think people rediscovered it after Knights of Cydonia was released and became a huge anime success. And they're like, why didn't I read this at the time? There's a bear with a rifle. Like, this is great. And it's just people, it's not the manga that people were reading in 2010 when this came out. So I really liked it and I'm going to keep reading it. It's like a really fun, fun, dark action adventure comic where the stakes are just, he's shooting nuclear missiles out of the sky with a laser at the end of the first volume. And it keeps going from there. I think that's pretty fun.
I just love that kind of audaciousness.
Yeah, same. If you can nail the tone for it, like, it's such a gift as a reader to see like something wild happen and like actually believe it.
Mm. Yeah.
Our next book. So this is the halfway point.
Oh, sorry, David, what do you think of it? Like,
I've been so focused on hosting.
Yeah.
I feel like this is the one where Nihei, it's going to sound condescending, but I mean it in a good way. Like, he discovered narrative. As opposed to setting.
Yeah.
Blam is like an incredibly realized setting, even though it's sort of a generic blank faceless thing. Like, it has a feel, it has a vibe. It doesn't feel good to look at, which I think is very impressive for an artist to pull off.
Yeah.
But Biomega is the one, like Chris was saying, where like he kind of keys in on like good characterization, like a little bit of humor, scaling back like the inky black edginess for like a little bit of something else, like better rendering, more interesting backgrounds, I thought was really interesting. Interesting backgrounds, I thought were really interesting.
Agreed.
Yeah, I'm just going to leave that in. Forget it. Do it. Abara. So this came out in 2006. This was during the serialization of Biomega.
Yeah.
It's a collection of short stories. It was published in 2006. They were probably actually made over a period of years. And Paymasters published it in 2018. It's a running dog of big manga over here. We couldn't read an entire first chapter for this one because it's just kind of the first half of the first chapter. Kind of generally, what did you guys think of the first chapter of Abara? Did it grab you?
He's doing some really weird stuff with faces here and like hyper detailed rendering of his male characters that I think is really interesting. Mm-hmm. You could see it on page, I guess that's page 12, or even the previous page where it's almost photorealistic, like all these tiny hatches are trying to get, but otherwise it looks like the other things, but the faces, he's doing something of the male characters. He's doing something really weird with the women still look like anime, like still have that, like, I'm not drawing a woman, I'm drawing an anime version of a woman.
Like, she doesn't really need pores.
Right? Yeah. Or like centered eyes, or like, yeah.
Of her nose.
She has the same expression no matter what is happening.
Yeah.
I mean, most of them, the male characters for the most part do as well. Even when the male character is really angry, it's just like, just kind of yelling.
Yeah.
There's kind of a standard kind of a problem with art, whether it be fine art or comic art or whatever in general, which is to wash away the features on the faces of the female characters, because anything else, people's brains just can't get it. It's like, what? Oh, why is she ugly? And I remember, this is a digression. Well, I used to assist an illustrator who did realistic oil paintings. He did a lot of like client work. And the one thing he taught me was, there are no lines in the teeth of women. Like, if a woman smiles, you do not delineate the teeth, because they will just be like, why'd you make me look ugly? And they won't even know what is wrong. But as soon as you get rid of all the lines in the teeth, it's like, that's fascinating. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, and he had a lot of examples of like clients being upset because he depicted them accurately. Nice. So, like, I think about that a lot, especially with a work like this, where you can see like, yeah, the female characters' faces are very much kind of washed away of any kind of like delineation lines, defining features, and you know, I fall prey to that as well as an artist. It's something that's really hard to get out of.
Yeah,
yeah.
I was really impressed by the architecture in this one as well. Like, there are so many shots of the setting, like a weird vertical city that they live in, crooked city on top of that, that I really wanted to know more about how they got here, kind of what it's like. And his rendering, it feels like it took another leap. Like maybe this was Biomega era, maybe it was, you know, a little bit before, but I can see how it feels like there's continuity so far.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense.
In this one, he discovered tubes.
Yeah.
Abra is all about tubes.
I was going to say, like, this particular one, it reminded me of Kowloon Walled City.
Yeah.
You know, this kind of decay and this randomness of the architecture. Like, I'm super fascinated by Kowloon Walled City. I bought, like, the big $100 art book. That
I've got, like, two books on it,
has, too. Like, all the architecture and stuff like that. I think you went to that place that mimicked
in
it,
Yokohama,
right?
Yeah. Or in Kawasaki. There's a video game arcade where it was patterned after Kowloon Walled City, which was this... Well, sorry, for folks who don't know who are listening, Kowloon Walled City was the Kowloon region of Hong Kong. It has a really troubled history, so we're only going to gloss it real quickly here. I apologize.
But
basically, it became tenements and slums that people who lived there built up themselves based on the sort of public housing that was already there. Things like connecting buildings together with unapproved bridges at like 15 stories up and that kind of thing. Things got so dense and so built over that like light didn't even enter the core of the city anymore. It was eventually torn down. Kowloon has been sort of repopulated, resettled in Hong Kong. Yeah, this like space, this like place where people live that are off the grid. And you know what? I think I maybe missed it when I read this, but I think you're absolutely right. This place, unlike everything else, even noise to an extent, feels like a place that people live, whereas the other places feel like wastelands that people are trying to survive, you know, not die. And this one is just like, like apartments are where he walks into the medical clinic and the stairs are full of people sitting on them. Just like you almost think they're like it's refuse or garbage at first. And then you're like, oh, that's people that are just like camped out trying to see a doctor. And you're like, the environmental storytelling is much stronger in this than I think it was in Noise or Blam. I think it's about on par with Biomega, but Biomega is trying to do something very different than this as well. Yeah. So it's hard to compare.
Biomega is more cosmic. This is more like it's in stuff in space.
Yeah. You
know? Versus gritty city full of stuff and nooks and crannies, and it's scary. And then like, it's more terrestrial.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's like designed by people.
Cowboy Bebop versus Gurren Lagann, kind of. If Biomega was the book where he kind of like kicked up his narrative game, Knights of Cydonia is the one where he's like, oh yeah, I can tell jokes in comics too.
Yeah.
Because what I did not remember about the first chapter of this series, which I liked quite a bit, is that like the first, I don't know, 36 pages are just pratfalls pretty much.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's him just stumbling through
and getting attacked and just horrible things happening.
Running into a room full of naked girls.
Which happened several times over the course of the series. Like it's a thing.
This was something I brought up in the interview. And I said, like, this feels like a really different kind of like approach.
Yeah.
Like you're drawing the characters cuter and younger and there's more fan service. And I think he kind of said something like, I figured out it was time to make manga that people liked.
Wow.
And not just stuff that entertained myself and my artistic sensibilities. Like this was kind of his take on, I don't know, trying to like tap into what's popular in manga, which is frankly moe. I mean, before it was a much darker sci-fi, right? This is more fun sci-fi.
Yeah, this is giant robot sci-fi. Space adventure. Chip, what'd you think of this one?
It was fine. I mean, yeah, like it's definitely, it's a very different style. And I chuckled a lot, and sometimes I think I chuckled maybe at things that weren't meant to be funny.
Oh, like?
Mostly just like kind of the over-explaining of things. Like that always kind of cracks me up, but especially in a story like this, which is already has a kind of a humor bent to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was cute, and out of all the stories, this is the one that kind of made me want to kind of see what happens next, just to see where the humor of it went. The style was super interesting to me, because the people still aren't necessarily well drawn, but they're trying something different. And it actually falls down, like, how do I say this? Like, knowing what comes after this, this makes a lot of sense as they're kind of stripping away the black.
Mm-hmm.
Because the black is actually used quite poorly in this.
Because
there will just be scenes where, like, let's see, like page 23, the top where he's in bed. Like, they're just laying in black to, like, pop things out that don't actually add dimension to things necessarily. Mm. Like, so there's a lot of kind of randomness to where they're going, like thick versus thin with their line or filling in black versus not. And you can see they've got one foot out the door in terms of utilizing black in their work, which is pretty interesting. Yeah, it made a lot of sense when we moved on to the next story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really funny, too, just the idea that they were doing this to kind of do what was felt like would be a popular manga.
Yeah.
Because now it really makes sense why that bear is in this one as well. Clearly, after getting all the questions about the bear, they're just like, well, clearly they like bears, so I'm just going to throw a bear in there.
They're like gorillas in DC Comics.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
this series really made an impression on me. Like the drastic switch in style. It's almost like going from being an underground cartoonist to like wanting to make X-Men, you know?
Yeah.
And not skipping the step. I mean, and skipping the steps in between.
Yeah.
Like it's so much more clean. It's so much more bright, but it's still, despite all the jokes, like as the series goes on, it has that same kind of grim, like foreboding. As you find out like what the monsters are. Because essentially, in Knights of Cydonia, all of humanity left Earth on two seed ships. One was called Apocyms, which you never hear about again. And the other was called Cydonia, which is the one, like this setting. And it's thousands of years in the future. Like the Earth was actually chopped in half at one point. Like so much goes on.
What?
Yeah, amazing space opera. Great drawings. But when the space battles happen, it gets really violent. Like, that edge is still there. There's a bit where essentially the gravity in the ship changes, which they foreshadow in chapter one. And there are all these panels of just people kind of splatting against the wall from, like, 500 feet out. And it's, like, the most impersonal, gross-feeling thing I'd seen in a long time.
Wow.
Mm. Wow.
Chris, what did you think of Cydonia?
I mean, everything you guys have said, it definitely is a bridging piece. Where he's like, what if I made a comic that actually sold? I think that is like, yeah, I think that that's probably a good thing for him. It's, you know, as a creator, I hope it got turned into an anime. It was huge. This was his best-selling work by far. I'm glad it made him some money and more of a household name. But it gets too far away from what I like about his work from an artistic point of view. But I think in terms of big ideas, you don't really get, the first chapter is pure jokes. Like it's actually got a little bit of like teases a little bit of plot. It's got a ton of humor. It's got some fan service, some naked ladies. And it's just like, oh, this is how you write a first manga chapter if you want to go to serialization. You know what I mean? Like it feels very like he's smart enough. Maybe he's been smart enough all along to know what the system is. But now he's like, all right, here you go. This is what you want, right? And it's like, oh my God, yeah, here's an anime deal. And statues and toys and all kinds of stuff that came with Knights of Cydonia. But if I hadn't talked to my buddy Derek, who I actually saw over the weekend, Halliday, if you're listening, Derek, hi, who was just like, oh, you're doing Knights of Cydonia and you're going to talk about that? And I was like, well, no, we're doing Apocyms. But he's like, no, Knights of Cydonia is the one. Like, there's so many good ideas in here about like relationships and gender and like there's so much stuff that goes on in Knights of Cydonia that is not even hinted at in this first chapter that I almost think the first chapter, is as solid as it is, kind of does it a disservice, because it feels like it's going to be, you know, Gundam Light or something.
Yeah.
And I don't think I'm going to read 15 volumes of this, to be completely honest with you. It's just a little bit too much, too far away from what I like about his stuff. I am going to go back and read Biomega. But, you know, there's only 2 seasons in the anime, and it apparently tells the whole story. Like, it's sitting there on Netflix for me right now, and I got nothing to watch. Maybe that is the way to, maybe if this is conceived as something that could be turned into anime, then anime is the ultimate form of it, and I should watch that instead. But
I think that came up was that the story is easier to understand in the anime than it is in the manga.
Mm.
Okay.
It usually, that people, that, I mean, that's, but that's anime though. Like, yeah, you hire, you, this is like one dude, right? And he's sitting there at the drawing table cranking out 30 pages a week. And then it's like, okay, I've written all this stuff, turned it into a TV show, and you get like a team of people that are smart, writers and artists and animators, designers, and they take like 12 volumes or 15 volumes of a thing and turn it into 26 episodes, like, or two 13 episode series or whatever it was. And you have like these people squishing it down or whatever. And I really want to get into this idea, but I was sort of saving it for Sailor Moon, frankly, because Chip had used to watch Sailor Moon when it was an anime and hasn't read the manga. And those two things, I mean, those three things are so far apart that the creator of the manga went back and demanded a new anime that was more faithful to her manga.
What?
Yeah. That's what Sailor Moon Crystal was. So like, I would love to talk about that at some point, but reading one chapter of a series seems unfair to hold it to that. But yeah, I would probably read the, I would probably watch the first couple episodes of the anime for this, but I don't think I'd read the series.
Deb, how did you think about this anime versus manga?
It made more sense. It's been a while since I watched the anime, but I remember thinking, oh, okay. So this is the world, and this is why all the girls look alike. Mm-hmm. And this is why the things are like they are. You know, it just like it framed it up in a way that was easy for me to follow, and also teed up each subsequent episode in a way that made me want to continue. When I'm reading this first chapter of Knights of Cydonia, I don't know. It's just kind of funny because it's a lot of different things at once. Mm-hmm. I mostly look at it from the like how strikingly different it is from Biomega art wise.
Mm-hmm.
Like, wow, so different.
Like it's a pop song in comparison.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
I love when artists do that, though. Like, really switch it up. And then it's like, what are you obsessed with in this series? So we made it to our final book. We're at Apocyms.
All right.
Published by Kodansha. We read a full volume for this one. Mm-hmm. And the gist of this one, according to kodansha.us/series/Apocyms, this story takes place on the frigid, massive artificial planet known as Apocyms. Ao, Biko, and Ethero, maybe Ethero, residents of the White Diamond Beam, are in the middle of combat training when suddenly a girl appears, Rebidoan Empire soldiers in hot pursuit. The girl asks for their help in keeping safe a code and 7 mysterious bullets. This chance encounter marks a major shift in the fate of the entire planet. And all of that is over with about 2/3 into the first chapter.
Yeah.
Like, you waste no time.
Yeah.
This is another drastic art change, but it's still sort of in Nihei's wheelhouse. Like, there are things like the Ghana, the architecture. It feels like his work. But, Chip, what did you think about this? You mentioned it, you called it masterful earlier?
Yeah, no, it's gorgeous, like, straight through.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, they've learned a lot over the course of all these different books. Yeah, every couple of pages, I was taken aback by the layouts and the rendering choices. Anatomy, I think, at this point, is finally locked in. Mm. Like even with the Knights of Cydonia, like there were a few kind of like, yeah, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But here, characters and environments are all top-notch. And it also does a thing that I'm a huge fan of, which is introduce a bunch of characters and then just kill them off.
I hadn't read the first chapter in a few years now, right when it was serialized on Crunchyroll.
Yeah.
And so I forgot that all those characters died, because I kind of remember the supporting cast from later in the series. Oh, so good.
Yeah. It's super well done. And like, they're even like, every once in a while, there's like a weird little funny part. It's like they've kind of they've learned from everything they've done. Like they've still created like, oh, it's still like a weird world where there's things kind of out there and you have to be careful, but there's also little hints here and there of humor. Mm-hmm. Like I don't even know what you call it, the weird little device character. When it starts urinating.
Yeah,
that single and it has to let them know so this good. Is not bodily waste, like, because it's just such a funny shape, and to see that shape pissing is just
like it really looks like Nihei referenced a cat for that specific drawing.
Yeah, yeah. I have to admit too that I laughed. Like there's still, you can see underneath it all, there's still maybe an element there, especially now that I know that the previous book was done to be like, oh, what do people want? What's popular? Here we go. Mm-hmm. There's what is it, page 127? Yiyu has several regular frame underlings in a northern composite slab region. You can defeat them one by one. If you do that, then you can grow stronger while closing in on Yiyu at the same time. Like, that right there is just such a standard, like, unbeatable idea.
Yeah.
Like, oh, here we go. Here's the series. Mm-hmm. Okay, Scott, you got to go and defeat all seven X's to get to Gideon. Like, it's such a familiar beat that I actually laughed out loud when I hit that page.
What I didn't realize is this is also kind of a 7 billion needles kind of story where someone dies and is reincarnated with powers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. 100%. Aww. Yeah.
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 Chris, what'd you think?
I actually read this when it was coming out. They did a simulpub for this, which was weird at the time because it wasn't as big of a deal. Even Shonen Jump wasn't simulpubbing everything, I think, at that point. And it was like, okay, the first chapter of the new Nihei's out and we're selling it as a $1.99 digital single. Big deal. And you're thinking, okay, like, that's a little weird, but the first chapter is 80 pages, by the way. Yeah. And also, the first chapter, completely free to read, all 86 pages of it or whatever it is on the Kodansha site, which is actually really cool of them. It's like half the book. So I read that, and then I read the second chapter, and I read the third chapter when it was coming out. And then when I went back to read this, I realized that the first volume is only three chapters because the chapters are so long, and the first one's 86 pages. So I actually had read Apple Sims Volume 1, and I was like, I got to the end of it, and I was like, oh, I'm ready for this next thing. Like, I want to see what happens next, because I was already kind of on board. And that was not the scope of this episode, so I didn't read ahead. And maybe I'll go drop another $9 on today's episode. But yeah, short version. Yeah, it's hitting the mark, I think. It's interesting, too, because he's doing with Negative Space, or with White, with like what he was doing with Black Ink in the first, in Blom. Like, he's actually figured out a way to use the complete absence of ink in a way to enhance the kind of story he's telling, in a way he used to slap down black, you know, ink on the page to tell that kind of story. And I think that that's fascinating because those two things are the same thing usually, but not in comics. People don't use Negative Space that way. I think honestly, readers feel cheated when there's not enough marks on the page, which is why Rob Liefeld was such a big success. So many tiny little lines.
It's a great,
which isn't to say
return on
investment. Yeah, right. Yeah, I want to see all the little marks. It's not to say that there's not detail into this work, or there's not thought, or like, you know, even the first couple pages, all these characters are in, like, you know, basically winter excavation suits so that they can survive on the exterior of this thing. There's tons of detail. Every little satchel has a flap and then something holding the flap closed. The boots have like tape from where they've been repaired countless times because materials are scarce. Like, there's so much good use of detail in this that really lends, I don't know, veracity to like his setting and his character designs and his characters. And then he just friggin' murders a bunch of them, which I think is also so funny. And the one that you think is going to be the lead character, the like only dark haired young shonen go-getter character, boom, half of his head's gone in like one panel. It was so good. And then the loner who doesn't talk to anybody ends up being the lead. I love that. I love that. Like, he knows what he's doing. No, there you go. He knows what he's doing, and it's really on display here. Like, he's just, oh, I'm really good at comics now. Watch. And then he shows you, and he is right, actually.
Yeah, that was
100%. That was my takeaway, but now I'm afraid we've set the bar very high. If Deb doesn't like it, I don't know what's going to happen. Deb, what do you think of Apple Sims?
No, I get it. I think it's
I get it.
No, I get that. What I found really interesting about that is like you say, it's the absence of effort. You know, I mean, the absence. Like if you look at Blem, it's like here's this guy trying really hard. Mm. You know, like trying hard to put a lot to with you know putting a lot of lines and trying to create mood. Mm-hmm. And this was much more reductive and much more purposeful in how he shows action and does the storytelling. Yeah, boy, how he kills all those characters. Chapter one, wow.
And the way he draws the violence, too, is dehumanizing, I guess is a good word for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
These are not pretty deaths. And I guess what I feel like this is him reaching... I thought it was really interesting to have to read all of his work in single chapters all at once because you really start to see that he has some certain themes. And if you really thought about it, maybe all of these stories exist in the same universe.
Mm-hmm.
The settings are very mechanical, man-made, but the villains or the enemies are very organic and mutated, like nature gone wrong, nature revolting. Against man.
That's interesting because the villains are also artificial. I'm going to be thinking about that forever. That's really good. But yeah, there's totally themes, like you were saying. In Biomega, they mentioned Toa Heavy Industries. Mm-hmm. That actually carries through several other series. I believe it shows up in Cydonia. It's mentioned in something else. But it's also like part of the design for the Blam books, like Toa Heavy Industries. It's one of his trademarks.
It's his business card. It says Toa Heavy. Awesome.
Yeah. Sorry, he started a company in the real world called Toa Heavy Industries LLC. And it's a partnership between him and what's the name of the company that did the people that did the Knights of Cydonia anime?
Oh, Polygon?
Polygon Pictures. Yeah, they formed a company called Toa Heavy Industries. And that's his company now. That's where him as a... That's his Zdarsko is Toa Heavy Industries.
I feel like that's like if they made Marvel Comics at the Baxter Building, you know, like somehow that was both a real place and also.
well,
that's a great idea.
We were talking like in Tezuka, right? Tezuka has his cast of characters and everything kind of happens within a certain style or certain themes that he repeats over and over again. I feel like that's what he's doing here.
Yeah.
You know? Like, he never explains what Gauna is, and he refuses to explain what a Gauna is. But then when I was reading Schnick, like, okay. Like, one of his key, I thought, why is he drawing a Wolverine comic? It's like, oh, because one of his key themes in his sci-fi is about mutation.
Oh, yeah.
Mm.
One of the books we're not talking about that he worked on is Wolverine Schnick, which was published, like, post-bankruptcy era Marvel, when they would put out anything. In like the best possible sense, like so many awesome comics came from that era, including full color left to right Tsutomu Nihei with Wolverine basically going to the Blam universe, and it ends on a Jim Morrison quote. It's such like a strange book.
So strange.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. But yeah, Apple Sims, it's actually ending next week as we record this.
Oh, August
25th is the final issue. So a complete story. I think there's 16 or 20 volumes, something like that.
Okay.
There's quite a few at any rate. So there's
really?
A decent wait.
I thought it was much shorter. Yeah, there's 7 that's available in English, and there's 8 listed on the internet as having
been
released.
What am I thinking of? Anyway, Chris is right. I am incorrect.
No.
I did not do the homework.
Oh, no.
But is it ending?
It is ending.
Yeah.
So I'm excited to see kind of where he takes the story because... Like I mentioned earlier, Knights of Cydonia was one setting. This series is named after the other seed ship that left Earth to escape to Gauna.
Okay.
And this is on a structure. They say it's 120,000 kilometers across. Earth is only 10,000 kilometers diameter. So it's, you know, enormous. So it kind of, he could go anywhere and do anything. And that's really exciting for a creator like this. It clearly has obsessions, but also like doesn't take him super seriously, like the peeing moment.
I so rarely see hard sci-fi anymore, you know?
Mm.
It's interesting that he's so into it.
Yeah.
Do you think he's cyberpunk? Like, is he still cyberpunk, I guess, is a good way to put it? Or have we kind of moved past that?
It's weird because before this year when the game came out, I would have said cyberpunk was dead. So if he's still cyberpunk, then he's pushing things in a really interesting new direction. Where, you know what I mean? But I think the idea of cyberpunk ends up being a little regressive. Sometimes we want this one specific version of the future, and we're going to keep iterating that version. Whereas he feels like he's moved past it a little bit. Like, there's a humanity in Aposims that is not present in Blam or Noise or even Biomega. He takes a minute in this first volume to have the lead character encounter a village. It's like, oh, the good guys are harvesting water, planting food, searching for things like naturalistic things, right? Like Deb was getting at, all the dudes that are bad guys are all, you know, vicious metal machine things. But I've read a bunch of Nihei. The idea that someone's going to like have to drill for water or grow fruit is kind of a new idea in this. You know what I mean? Like, even the rice, it's like all these people are photosynthesizing in Knights of Sidonia. They don't need to eat if they don't want to more than once a week. It's like a human. It's like a base concern. It's not really where they're at. So I think that's a big part of this, is that it's like, yeah, you can have all the future fancy shit and have a metal arm or whatever, but people still got to eat. People still got to survive. Yeah. Things are still rough, and it's not just about hacking and freaking and being cool, you know? And I think that maybe this is a better future for something that you would call cyberpunk, but it's not, I don't think it is cyberpunk anymore. I think we have decided that word means a very specific time and place.
Okay. I was going to say, you should read the Blam Academy one, because there's a really neat essay at the end of it where this guy writes about that cyberpunk is kind of like is an anti-futurist point of view, that, you know, whereas before, you know, technology is going to save the world, right? Technology is going to make us have better lives. And then the anti-futurist point of view is that technology is a weapon that threatens human society. And we're kind of seeing that, right? I mean, like Facebook almost brought down democracy, American democracy. Facebook is killing us because people think that vaccines are fake. You know what I mean? So it's like we're living that now. And so sometimes, like, reading this kind of cyberpunk type of thing is like, can I just get some cute girls? Because this shit's too real now.
Extremely relatable point.
Yeah.
So I do want to say Aposims opens on a bridge, just like Blam and Biomega did. So maybe that is the secret.
Oh, hey, there you go.
That's actually a really good metaphor, though. Mm-hmm. Like, the idea of you, the reader, coming to join him. And I still have 1,000 ideas. So we want to keep doing this. Let's go. Yeah. Chip, what do you got?
Just before we go, I just want to focus on the art a little bit longer. It's rare that you see work like this where it's black and white, where they use so little black. And the effect that it's had on the story is that it's almost radioactive. Like, everything just has like almost an ethereal glow to it. Like, even when somebody's in a hallway that, you know, has a little bit of gray shadow, it feels like you can't escape in this world. Mm-hmm. Like, wherever you go, there's going to be eyes on you. It's such a really, really fascinating mood that I haven't actually seen in a comic before. Because the default reaction is to, you know, add more black to like make it mysterious. But here it's like there's no escape because of the art style. Like, even when the characters are kind of hidden away, it doesn't feel like they're hidden away at all. And that's really fascinating.
It says something about the light in this on this world too, I think. It's radioactive is a good word for it, because it feels sickly, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like fluorescent versus warm, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely.
I'd be interested to see, like, knowing that they're finishing this, what they do next, because, like, obviously based on what Deb mentioned earlier, like, they don't care for adding black for logistical reasons. So I'm like, will this style continue, or will they figure out some other way of telling a story? Like,
Because it is different looking than Knights of Sidonia.
Yeah.
It's European-ish, almost.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, it feels sort of like evil Nausicaa. Like, where Miyazaki was working in, like, the Mobius sort of French kind of mode.
Yeah.
And this is the version of that where, like, cinder blocks destroy heads.
Yeah.
But, okay, so in lieu of a traditional final thought, I just want to get Chip's take on the color pages from Apocynes.
Oh yeah, let me pull them up and give you my hot take. I mean, if you would call these color pages, it's. I mean, unless I'm looking at a different version, mm-hmm. like there's basically the cover, a pinup, kind of a title page, like a splash page, and that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's all gray.
Pretty much.
Oh, no, there yeah. actually is color in the Kindle version of.
I mean, but it's still very desaturated. Is that the right word?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. I barely count these as color pages. They're rendered, extra rendered pages, and they're fine. That's my proclamation. They're fine. I don't think there's a lot of necessary care put into it. Really, mm-hmm. like it's just kind of like now that I know what I know that like these all have to start with color pages for some reason mm-hmm. to really pull people in. I can see they're just kind of doing what they have to do here, but. I don't know.
But Chip, let me show you what the color actually looks like on that double page spread. Because I think it's something, it's a little bit, I don't think it's totally different than what you're saying, but I do think it's different enough that maybe you want to see it.
What format did you read it in, Chip?
Yeah, yeah.
This one's on Comixology.
Yeah, I see. I'm seeing the same version.
Yeah.
It's got like, it's not necessarily gray, but the sky is like a little steel blue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely not. It's color. It's yeah. not a lot. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
yeah, yeah.
That's what I see too.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually, you really thought that was like, I don't know. It feels deliberate. It doesn't feel perfunctory to me, but I get what you're saying.
I mean, it's like, I think like half the time there are color pages in these, they're very much just super monochromatic because they just got to like just do it, get it done. Mm-hmm. And then the other half of times is just wild stabs at rendering in color that don't work. So I'll take this over the other any day.
Nice.
But also it's everything feels like a step down after the Spy Family covers.
And true. Color those pages. Are really good.
Yeah.
Actually, David, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Do you see a link between the artwork on 7 Billion Needles and the artwork of our good friend Tomonihe here? Because when we got to Knights of Sidonia, suddenly it felt a lot closer. To me, the kind of art he was doing.
I think they share surface similarities, like a similar line, kind of a similar kind of rendering, like very round, for lack of a better phrase. Mm-hmm. I didn't go to art school. I don't know anything. But I wouldn't necessarily compare them, except that they use similar techniques to, like, bubbly flesh is kind of a thing in both books, mm-hmm. as it transforms into another shape.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I do think they're cool touch points. Like, I do love finding artists who solve the same problem in different ways. Mm-hmm. They're cool to look at from that perspective.
You brought up 7 Billion Needles, and I was like thinking, like, oh, that was maybe the last like actual sci-fi book that we covered on here. Is it? I'm just looking at the shelf. I don't really see
Akira.
Yeah, I mean, Akira was first though, and first and always. But yeah, I guess it did. It didn't so much with Blam and Noise and mm-hmm. Biomega, but when it got into Knights of Sidonia, I'm like. There's a way that these characters move that feels a little bit like 7 Billion Needles to me. And that was 2008. And I think that's kind of like time-wise, they're not too far off. Knights of Sidonia was a little bit after. So
yeah,
maybe. Anyway.
Cool.
Anyway, just a thought. I wanted to get your take as the expert on both books.
Oh, no, not that. Before I get put on the spot anymore, we're going to take a quick break for some advertising, come back for a little more chatter, and picking three more books.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, we're back, and it is time for another Manga Blind Date. This segment is brought to you by Viz Media, who sent us this book to check out. None of us have read it, but we're just going to give it, well, we're just going into it blind. Let's see what we thought about it. Well, this time we are reading a book by someone we've read before and we've talked about on Manga Spinning before. This is Mao by Rumiko Takahashi. We talked about her work on Mermaid Saga, and this is her latest series. Let's see. Well, let's just dive right into it. How about you, Chris? What did you think of Mao?
So this was an interesting one because I really did go in blind. And I think on our last blind date with Junji Ito's Censor, I was like, if I had known like a little bit more about this before I read, I think I would have gotten into it more from the beginning, like realizing that the first couple chapters were set up. I'm glad I didn't know anything about this one because it felt a lot from the description to me like Takahashi's previous work, which was Rinne, which was a very, very long-running series that I did not like at all. And it's so difficult for me to admit that because I like Takahashi's Ranma was one of those like things that got me into anime and got me into manga. Maison Okoku was my favorite series for years and years. So I wasn't, when I found out what this was, I was like, oh no, it's going to be another Rinne. But yeah, I have to say that while this is not for me, clearly it is a Shonen Sunday title, I didn't mind it. I thought it had some really interesting ideas. I liked that it was set in the Taisho era partly, and that she would move back and forth. And that's an area that we've covered a lot, actually almost by accident on Manga Explaining, but particularly with Panorama Island. I like that it digs into yokai in a sort of a fuller way. And it's not in the middle of like a yokai boom or anything like that. It seems to come from a place of genuine interest by the author, which is always kind of nice. I liked that it, especially towards the end, moved in a mermaid saga direction, like a short horror of the week thing where there's a different monster they've got to investigate every week. But that said, the parts of the book that were closer to Rinne, and especially later in Inuyasha, where it's like there are lead characters that know exactly what's going on and they refused to tell each other how they feel or what's going on. And it feels artificial because the author needs to like dole these little bits out as the series goes on. Like if you're just sitting around and talking to somebody for 3 days, maybe you'll get around to talking about why you actually like have this scar or what you encountered. But instead we get like 3 pages of like backstory every chapter as the days move forward. And I found that to be really artificial in a way I didn't enjoy as a reader. Yeah, it's a mixed bag, but I think it's definitely stronger than some of the recent work I've read by Takahashi Sensei. And I liked that there were moments that made me remember the good, horrific parts of Mermaid Saga. That was my take.
How about you, Chip?
I mean, the only other works I can compare it to are Mermaid Saga. Like I've read bits of Maison Okoku and Ranma when I was younger, but I don't have a strong memory of it. So it's interesting to see the similarities, like the kind of the twists and the adding to the lore of a thing as you go through. I would say that much like Chris, this one isn't necessarily for me, but I feel like I could recommend it to younger readers. Like it feels like a horror adventure designed for a younger reader because there's nothing really horrific in this, but there's just enough to be like, ooh, this is like weirdly, you know, titillating for maybe a kid, but not as much for an adult. And I think the world building too would be kind of more interesting for a kid and piecing together the mystery. Whereas for me, it just feels like a lot of things are just kind of being tacked on as you kind of go through. There's a lot of repetition too. And asking the question like, what happened that day? Well, you know, what is this place? What is this place? There's a lot of that kind of repetition that made me feel like this is very much geared towards kids. But the cartooning is still excellent. It obviously doesn't have the kind of the old school flavor of Mermaid Saga with kind of the sweeping brushstrokes. Like this is a digitally produced book and you can see in a lot of spots that coming through. But the panel composition and the storytelling is still like top notch. There's one panel where I was just like, wow, it's so simple, but so well done, where the kid hands her hand back and she faints. And the fact that they managed to basically, essentially in 3 panels with like these weird interstitial panels, show her receiving it, passing out, and coming to. and you don't lose a step there in terms of failing to understand what's happening. Mm-hmm. Like it's a very simple method where the character kind of passes out towards the left side, and then there's the black strip panel, and then another panel of just kind of piecing her together again, and then she's facing the opposite direction. Like it's such a small thing, but as an artist, I'm just like, oh wow, that's super elegant. And clearly, even in her later works, she still has these kind of fun new tricks up her sleeve.
Yeah, I'm surprised by this one.
Yeah,
of course, I'm cynical in the way that anyone who's read manga a long time is can be cynical. Like, oh, okay, here's another girl and a guy, Rumiko Takahashi story, where the guy's magical and the girl's not, but kind of. And then they fight the monster of the week, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there was some interesting moments where I thought, oh, this is surprising. Like, I didn't expect her hand to come up. I didn't expect that moment when her eyes change and she has fangs. There seems to be like some kind of interesting mystery going on.
Mm-hmm.
It felt more compelling than Rinnei, with Winmei was kind of more jokes, even though it kind of had a similar formula. This one seems a little bit more serious and more horror oriented. It's compelling enough that I think I'd like to see where it goes from here. But it was not something that I automatically said, oh yeah, I got to pick this up when it first came out. So yeah. It's interesting to be put in the situation to read it, come in blind and go, oh, this is not quite, this is a little different than what I expected.
I will say, I feel like this is a more successful work than Rinnei, but it just, yeah, like I don't want to be like mean, because I don't think it deserves it, but the action is the thing that I can't get over, is that it's like an action comic, but the scenes, the sword slashing scenes and things like that. We talked a little bit about how Rumiko Takahashi draws action versus how other artists draw action. And it really is just like you get everything in one panel. And there's a couple of moments where I wish we had gotten a few more pages of, like, especially the fight between Byoko and Mao. I wish we had gotten a few more pages to actually show that fight scene. Instead, it was just sort of like one page with the word slash written 15 times or something like that. That was my biggest letdown from the series. But I really think that the setting, the Taisho era, actually does a lot of work here, because it gives a lot of visual interest. It's not like Inuyasha, which as far as I can remember, and I read 12 volumes and I kind of tapped out after that point, but a lot of Inuyasha seemed to be set in a field, just like a never-ending field with sparse trees, sort of like a forest. There wasn't really a town, and occasionally she would go back to like the real world or whatever. And in this one, it's like, oh, there's like a coffee house and there's like a mansion and there's like a whatever. And I thought that was really good. I actually really liked that it felt like it was in a place, and it added to that, like a girl spirited away to a different place kind of vibe, more so than some of the other works that I've read recently. I also really dug, I think the three characters that they've introduced are actually pretty fun. Like, I think Mao is like a brooding, you know, whatever. The Chiyoko is a pretty believable young lady. And then the little doll demon boy thing is like actually kind of hilarious. Like, you know, like, he's not overplayed. He's not overly cutesy. If this was a Disney movie, he would have had a rap song by now or something like that. Instead, he's just like, you know, kind of like just there for just enough comic relief that he doesn't get annoying. So
yeah, true.
I'm curious. I'm curious about where this goes.
All right. Now that you've been on a first blind date with Mao, would you go on a second? Would you seek out the second volume? What about you, Chip?
It's weird to say this in context of a date, but I would not go on another date, but I would recommend that a child go on a date with them.
No, that's gonna play.
There goes that metaphor. How about you, Chris?
Yeah, I think if I saw this at a store, I'd pick it up to see how at least the story that I'm reading that started at the end of this volume ends, like with the fake priestess. I think that's really interesting as like a thing. But yeah, you know, I read this book, I know it's not for me. And I do think it has just enough gore, just enough horror to like keep a younger reader sort of entertained. Like, there's a spider lady and she keeps a collection of young men's heads in which to lay her eggs. that's actually pretty gross as an idea, but it's gross in exactly the kind of way that like someone who's good at creating shonen manga would come up with to make a shonen manga reader go, that's gross. Oh my God. I need to see what happens next and flip the page.
Yeah. You know what yeah.
I
mean?
So I thought that like there's some good horror at like exactly that like 12, 13, 14 year old age level that I think that its intended audience maybe would dig. So yeah, this isn't the date for me and there won't be a second one, but I think I know somebody that would be perfect to fix Mao up with and I'll send that along. You know what I mean?
See, you did it in a less creepier way than I did. Good job. Yeah. Deb, how about you?
Well, I mean, I will say that it's hard for her to match the heights that she reached with her prior work, you know, and maybe it's partly something where I have such fond memories of Ranma 1/2 or like, you know, even Urusei Yatsura, which is just over the top nuts, or Maison of Koku, which is so masterful and heartfelt. This kind of feels a little bit, I don't know, like she's just kind of found a formula and she's working with it. She's trying to find some way to make it work anew. It's not something I think that will be as resonant to me, but maybe it's something, it's because like you're saying, I'm older and maybe I'm not in that space to feel that kind of attachment to this series. Mm. I think it's a good teen horror series though, and I think it's worth checking out. I'm not sure if I would kind of, you know, pre-order volume 2 right now, but I am curious to see where it goes from here. There are enough mysteries in this that I'm curious to see how they unfold. All right. So that was Mao Volume 1 by Rumiko Takahashi. It's available now from Viz Media in print and digital. Go to bit.ly/MaoPodcast to read a free preview.
And we are back. Thank you for listening to that advertisement. I've heard reports that some people don't get ads. If so, you are extremely blessed, but please PayPal us a quarter at your earliest convenience. So this is the week that we need to pick comics, new manga for Chip to read, and for us to talk about for people to listen to, which is the point of our manga explaining podcast. Chris, since I'm the host, I get to make you go first this time.
Everyone makes me go first when it's time. Anyway, whatever. Fine. Let's do this. Hey, Chip.
Hey, Chris.
What is the largest number of volumes you would be willing to read for 1 week of manga explaining?
Oh my God.
And your answer will determine whether I pick book A, which is in my head, or book B.
Well, I mean, first of all, you have given single volumes before that were equal to 8 volumes.
Yes. 5. So, but yes, go on.
So let's get real specific here. Are these volumes, how many pages are these volumes?
Actually pretty short, like 150.
Okay. All right. Yeah, okay, I would do 3.
Then what we're going to do, and you can decide at which point you would like to do it, is a series I like to call Tokyo Terareba Girls by Akiko Higashimura. Tokyo Terareba Girls has a special connection to you, which I think you're going to appreciate. Akiko Higashimura is one of the best, you know, Jose artists working today. It is about three ladies in Japan who are in their 30s and about to enter their 40s, which, you know, I know that you are interested in ladies of older ladies, let's say, people in their 40s.
Wait, what? Well, first of all, that's not 50s, older. 60s. I'm 45. That's not older. That's actually creepy if I'm interested in like someone in their 30s.
Actually,
frankly,
that's ancient in manga, so you're just going to have to roll with it.
All right. Sorry. Okay, yeah.
Too many 12-year-old protagonists. Anyway, they're looking for love, and they're finding it in all the wrong places. The series becomes a hit in Japan, actually, with these characters that are trying to find love and can't find love. And people start writing into the mangaka and going, oh my God, I'm just like the lead character. I can't find love. Please help me. And starting in the third volume, the mangaka starts answering their letters in the back of the book via comic strip form. And so if you were said 3 volumes, Tokyo Terareba, I thought, oh, you might be interested. So it's a mangaka turned advice columnist for ladies looking for love in Tokyo. Well, it is a comedy. Well. It is smart as hell. And to be completely honest, all three of us love it. So
it might have ruined my life a little bit.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Right? All right. Okay. Ruined David's life. I'm interested now.
So I think it's something you would really dig and something we've been talking about and referencing for a long time when it comes to Jose manga. So I think you'll really dig it. That's okay, all right. For the next book.
All right. I'll take it under advisement. Next.
And that is volumes 1, 2, and 3.
All right.
Not bad. Cool 600-ish pages. So I guess I have to go second, but that's okay because I was counterpicking Chris anyway. I'm going to read the description of mine, just a couple sentences out of it, and then see if I can sell you on it. High schooler Akiko has big plans to become a popular mangaka before she even graduates, but she needs to get much better at drawing if she ever wants to reach her goal. Looking for an easy fix, she signs up for an art class, thinking all her problems will soon be solved. She's in for a surprise. Her new instructor is a bamboo sword-wielding taskmaster who doesn't care about manga one bit. But maybe this unconventional art teacher is just what she needs to realize her dreams. So this is called Blank Canvas, My So-Called Artist's Journey, and it is by the same cartoonist who did Chris's book.
Wow. Wow.
Like semi-autobio story of her life growing up to become like a manga superstar.
Well played, David. Well played.
That's nice.
All right, Deb.
Okay. So remember when I said what I'm going to pick, it depends what the other guys say. So this was my alternate choice from last time. So it's called Blood on the Tracks. It's by a creator named Shuzo Oshimi. And basically it's kind of a suspense horror manga, but it's unlike any other suspense comic I've ever read. It's about a young boy and he's an only child and his mother is very protective. So protective that it starts to get really creepy. And then something happens. The mother does something unthinkable and this young boy has to decide whether to keep a secret or not.
Ooh, intriguing. Mm. Very good, Deb. Very good. All right. So let me just say, first of all, Chris, you're doing a lot better at these. You're describing it.
I'm finding connections directly to you. I'm not talking just about random shit.
Where you've gone wrong is just the amount. Mm. And so I'm going to push that off a little bit. David totally kneecapped you there. Yeah. By basically picking the same creator, except as one volume.
Oh, no.
Brilliant.
It's
brilliant.
Four volumes, though.
Oh, no, we're just doing one.
Four?
We're just doing one. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So I'm going to have David's pick as my number one.
Nice.
And because I don't want to do those back to back, Deb is going to be number two. And also because I need to buy myself some time because we've been really piling on the manga lately. Yours is number three. But they're all great picks.
Hmm. Like, I'm excited for Deb's.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you read it, David?
No, but that author continually grosses me out. So I'm in.
Yeah.
Bring it on.
Sounds good.
It's an incredibly unnerving manga.
Yeah. That's also a good mix of comedy, horror, or thriller comedy. So it should be a roller coaster.
Yeah. That's good.
I'm still kind of programming you guys.
this is the thing where normally one of you really loses, but I think in this case all of you won the picks this time because I genuinely want to read all three of these.
Yay.
That's great.
Yeah.
Hooray. I think we're all counterpicking each other. It's like a three-way standoff, and somehow Chip always wins.
That's the way I like it.
Yep. So we've got Chip's books. We've got a schedule. Deb, you've got our shout-out for the episode.
Oh.
What can you tell us about?
Well, I just started watching the Evangelion movies. They're now all four of them are out on Amazon Prime. I've watched several versions of Neon Genesis Evangelion, and yeah, it's a lot to take in. And apparently this version of four movies is the ultimate version where things tie up, where the story gets told in a way that I guess it's a remix in a way, but it kind of hits different beats and it makes it more cohesive and more meaningful. I've managed to avoid spoilers about the last one.
Yeah,
I'm so proud of myself.
Me too.
I think Neon Genesis Evangelion, I mean, I think David, you mentioned that maybe we would get Chip to read the manga one day because like Akira, it's kind of a seminal work.
Yeah.
And another work where the manga came out alongside the animation. So different staff on the manga, I suppose.
I'm a little afraid to watch the ending of Evangelion. It's been literally a constant in my life since I was 16, when I first started watching the VHS tapes. And I actually bought some of the VHS tapes because I couldn't wait for them to be available in rental. I actually never read the end of Lone Wolf and Cub either. That last big fight that's 26, 27, 28, even though I had read everything up to it, because the idea that it would be over, this like epic story that was like so, that lasted so long in my life. Mm-hmm. So I've held off on, I know it's been sitting there, and I actually even rented out a theater and invited a bunch of people to see Evangelion 1 and 2 for my birthday a couple of years ago.
Fancy.
I really dig that. But yeah, I don't know that I want it to end, even if the ending is good, even if the ending's bad. I don't think I want it to end. So, yeah.
I think the one person who wants it to end is Hideaki Anno.
I get that sense from him, actually.
I hear it almost killed him. And he's like, that's it. That's all. I'm just going to go and I'm going to do Kamen Rider Movie Desk. Deal.
I believe it. That's a good point for an upcoming episode of Manga Explaining, though. We should cover his wife's work, who is incredibly funny and has... She pokes a lot of holes in the auteur that is the creator of Evangelion.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
But we'll get there.
Did you see the short clip about the big turnip?
No.
What? No.
It's this anime. It's for the 10th anniversary of Studio Kara. And it talks about it uses this metaphor of the director, Anno, getting this field, and he starts growing things in it. And the first big turnip that pulls out of the is Evangelion 1.1. And then, you know, so it kind of starts talking about how he got burned out between 3 and 4 and just didn't want to come into the office anymore. It's pretty honest, even though it's kind of told in that visual style of insufficient direction.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I'll share it with you. I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah, we can show notes it for the listeners who aren't sharing Manga Explaining Studio with us right now. But that was our episode. We talked about Tsutomu Nihei a bunch. Hopefully you learned something. Hopefully you're going to go out and spend a bunch of money on his work. And if not, don't tell us about it. And we will see you next week, where Chris, you're hosting, right?
Yeah. Next week we are doing... Wait, what are we doing next week?
Imitation from a Crab.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. Sorry. It's been that kind of week. Yeah. Imitation from a Crab. I'm actually looking forward to a lot. We haven't done anything that we would consider alternative, with hard air quotes, scare quotes on that, alternative manga yet. And I think I literally can't wait for Chip to tear it to pieces, even though it's great. It'll be fun.
Well, let's see.
I can't wait for Chip to love it and disappoint Chris.
Yeah.
I would be delighted to be disappointed.
All right.
Kind of a catch-22. But right? On behalf of Deb, Chris, and Chip, I am David, and thank you for listening to Manga Explaining. This has been Manga Explaining Season 2, Episode 3. Thanks for listening. For our next episode, we'll be discussing the manga An Invitation from a Crab. Want to pick up a copy? Consider supporting your local comic book and manga specialty shop. Find one near you at comicshoplocator.com or check out your local library for print and digital lending options. You can also follow along with our complete reading list at mangasplaining.com. Thanks to DADS for their musical accompaniment this episode.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.